evening is yours for whatever you wish to bring up. I will simply moderate in case things get either disorganized or uncontrolled. John?
I'm sure that the responses will come on many levels. One, I guess the thing that I would say was my continuing image when I left was the gradual change in appearance, manner, cockiness, just a change in Oppenheimer himself the kind of pork pie hat and I don't think it's necessary for me to try to describe the first, but as you came and then the image of the last one and the quote of "We are deaf and deaf to the nation" or something, and the interview where he was trying to light his pipe and anything but kind of on top of things. I have an image of a person as one of the lasting impressions of the film. What it did to him and how visually you saw that in photographs.
One of the things that struck me was that while the scientists were taking bets on the size or the power of the blast, Enrico Fermi, one of the prime physicists of the age, was taking side bets on the possibility of vaporizing New Mexico. It just amazes me that there would even be receptivity to that uncertainty amongst the group of people carrying out any experiment.
Well, it didn't. Sometimes one can take side bets on something that one thinks is infinitesimal, at least small, even inconceivable possibility.
I do remember reading elsewhere that there was the possibility in some people's mind that there would be a chain reaction created, since such a fission had never occurred before, that there would be a possibility of triggering a chain which would continue way beyond the carrier of the blast, and there's still that real possibility.
Had the scientists perhaps ruled that out, however?
My reading was that they had not completely, that there was that possibility.
And I think I was struck by the idea that while they were working on it, since they were scientists, they were excited about the project, but they didn't seem to see beyond it how it was going to be used. It was like they otherwise didn't see it, or they were naive about it. I got the impression that they thought it was going to be used as a scare tactic and dropped in places where people weren't at. I couldn't quite believe that.
There was a sense in which it was unreal to them. They talked about it as a gadget, mm-hmm. and it's become just a challenge to the scientists in the game. And I was really struck by the response of when it was dropped in Hiroshima. First, we're glad it wasn't a dud, and then secondly, the beginning to the impact on them of exactly what it had done.
I think that, they're scientists. I mean, Oppenheimer was a theoretical physicist. A chance to see that theory come to life, I mean, that must have been so exciting for someone to kind of push the possibility of their discipline to the limit. I could see myself getting involved with something like that, but they didn't see beyond, and that's what scares me. Will I not see beyond? Are we all kind of...
They never stopped to examine the implications of what they were doing. And the one, what sticks in my mind is the one guy who said, "I don't know why, when the Germans surrendered, I didn't pull out of the project." He said, "I wish I had pulled out of the project." But it just never really occurred to any of us. We never stopped to think about that. And that says to me, well, if I'm involved in any kind of, if I'm involved in a nuclear project right now, I need to stop and think about it and maybe pull out of it, rather than just going along with what's happening.
But one man did hold that session, wasn't it? Wilson?
That was the same guy who said that.
The same guy. That guy was the one consistent at the end. one part of the movie, he said he's left the whole research of nuclear.
I didn't understand that, because he seemed to contradict himself when he said that he was the one. First he said he didn't even think about pulling out, and then he said he was the one that held the meeting about the effect of the gadget or whatever. He's, you know, he seemed to say at first that he hadn't really thought of the implications of it, and then after he said that he was the one that held that meeting for about 30 to 50 people.
Occasionally I'll play the devil's advocate here. It's partly what the way I earn my bread. But isn't it conceivable that in their minds, at least, a scientist did have to give a certain kind of basic political assent to a larger process when he or she participated in the development of the technology that might then be used in a political context. But that was already given. At least it seemed in the movie that these scientists wouldn't have gotten involved in it, nearly as many of them wouldn't have gotten involved in it. Oppenheimer wouldn't, if it hadn't been for the whole setting of World War II. So there was some kind of background consideration of political agreement with the possible uses of this weapon. But then, mightn't they say, we're not government decision makers, we're not at that level of decision making, and so when the context changed a bit within the war, Japan, after all, is still a very major enemy. It was the one that got us, most immediately got us involved in the war. It's a very natural tendency for human beings to say that it isn't their role to jump in at a more detailed level. Certainly the political considerations necessary to say, well, now that Germany's out of the war, we won't go any further with the project, are much more intricate than the initial political agreement of getting involved in the whole project. And how can you expect human beings to pull out at, how can you expect scientists to pull out at that level? Are they really obligated to get involved in that much more detail at that level? Isn't the blame, if it's to be put in this situation, to be put on the political decision makers, not on those people in the Manhattan Project?
I think the comments that were made in the movie, however, indicated something different. At least I interpreted them differently. There was a stated support, even enthusiasm, on the part of the scientists for the project because it might mean the defeat of Germany. That is, they were told, we will develop this in order to end the war against the Germans. And so there
was it just against the Germans?
There was an expressed kind of patriotic statement on their part. However, what was striking from Frank Oppenheimer and others in the movie was that the same folks that said that and entered into it with that being the goal of their work, said that when Germany was defeated, they were so taken, now this is an interpretation, with the project itself that it did not occur to them to ask, if our goal has been reached, namely the defeat of Germany, why are we going on with this? There was a lure of their science and of their technology, and there was an investment of their professional selves in the project itself that caused them just to go on without even asking the same kinds without asking about the goal, and they entered the project because of the stated goal.
But in the meantime, hasn't Japan become a very major enemy?
Yeah, but why not the discussion then?
Well, Japan is still at war.
I know. No, why wasn't their point? Their stated point was that we didn't talk about Japan.
You've got to put this thing back into its perspective. After all, who was the major threat so far as the atomic armies at that point? Heck, the British, in Britain, when the British bombed the heavy water plant in in Norway. We knew the heavy water plant was there, and what was it about? We knew what it was about. And Peenemunde, this is where the German, the work is going there, and what were they working on? Well, one of the things they were working on was the heavy water. Now, this is, we're working on atomic bombs, and we knew it. And it was either going to come out of our arsenal, or it was going to come out of the German. Now, we're afraid of the Germans on the atomic bomb.
I don't understand. You lost me. I mean, what? How does your point relate to Larry's? I'm sorry.
It supports Larry's. Oh. That in fact Germany was the threat vis-a-vis which the atomic bomb became so important.
The only rationale for using the atomic bomb against Japan is that it would save our men.
That's what Truman kept saying. But the planned invasion wasn't until November, and the bomb you dropped in August.
Yeah. One other side of it that impressed me was the personal tragedy in Oppenheimer's life, that he was actually motivated partly by his Jewishness, that so many of his fellow Jews were being exterminated, and that motivated him at least initially. I think it brought it out in the film, and the irony of the whole thing was then that finally he was unable to do anything against the Nazis, but finally ended up being, implementing the whole thing in terms of destroying another mass of innocent people who are in many ways parallel to his own Jewish compatriots that he was concerned about in the beginning. And it just makes one feel this is the nature of evil, that one does become drawn in maybe through indignation or just motivation. And in the end, one joins the opposite side, and makes one wonder, was his lot in the end better than some of his fellow countrymen who were annihilated? At least they died, innocently, but he has on his conscience the blood of thousands of Japanese people. That to me is a very personal question.
I got the impression in the movie also that you can't, you just cannot control evil. Here, there seemed to be a good reason on the part of Oppenheimer for, at the beginning. He had this thing that he needed to do in his own mind, and he wanted to, as far as taking care of Germany, because he had lost many of his fellow countrymen. Then, when that war was over, he didn't really want to. I got the impression, anyway, he didn't want to use this to destroy people's lives. He wanted to have this instrument as a show to see, okay, we hold the upper hand. But the political powers took it out of his hands at that point. And there was nothing he could do. The instrument was here. Whether he wanted it used that way or not made no difference. And isn't that the way a lot of times, don't you? You start dealing with an evil, and pretty soon you don't control it at all.
One of the other factors, I think, in the decision for the failure to stop the project at the time that Germany was defeated is that in all the way through most of our history, technology seems to have, the development of technology doesn't seem to have much of a stopping point. In other words, I haven't seen a lot of cases where once new technology is developed that consciousness comes into it to stop it. And some people say one of the first times a clear demonstration of the stopping forward movement to bigger and faster and more productive systems was in the case of the SST, where all of a sudden we said we don't need to continue that technology to save a couple hours on a transatlantic flight. Let's stop it. That consciousness really didn't exist very much at that time during World War II.
What antecedents are there here for the scientist's responsibility to say no to an advance in technology? I don't know enough about the history of science and technology to know
mustard gas is one, perhaps you could point out as an example on the other side of the tissue. It did stop the development of mustard gas and
when was that?
World War I.
But that was a decision by scientists, aware of their own responsibilities, or was it a political decision after that?
Right.
It wasn't scientists limiting their own.
As a matter of fact, the scientific development of chemical agents was not stopped. It was outlawed as a weapon of war. But our scientists and other scientists continued the research on the subject. I attended a demonstration at Dugway Proving Ground, south of Salt Lake City, in which they demonstrated a variety of chemical agents in World War II. And agents that I was a chemical officer in World War II. And we had not been taught about it until I went to that. I've been a chemical officer for 2 years before I heard some of these agents they developed. They're still developing. Dropped the bombs in among a bunch of sheep and then performed an autopsy. It shows the physical effects. We were still dedicated to not using them. This was still the official policy, and I see no reason to believe we were, I think I know beyond any shadow of a doubt, we were not intending to use them. We were developing our own intelligence of the subject, partly to guard against them in Europe during World War II. One of my assignments to be on the alert for signs of chemical agents being stored by the German people and the munitions to convey them to targets and all that. And we didn't find them, but this is one of the assignments where they didn't watch for us. But they were developing them.
Tom?
I hope I can connect this for us all. It's not really well connected in my own mind, so that's a bit of an excuse there. For years, I've been very interested in being sort of a scientist, a biologist, in this atomic problem. Oppenheimer's trouble is not without precedent. And strangely enough, in my opinion, the development of the bomb is connected to a monstrous change in science brought about in the last century by, of all people, a pacifist. And I'm speaking of Alfred Nobel. He invented dynamite for purely peaceful purposes. We, up until that time, had no explosive that was really powerful and yet relatively safe. Nitroglycerin was simply too touchy to use safely, and things like black powder just didn't do the job. So dynamite was utilizing nitroglycerin in a relatively safe way. Well, Nobel was so horrified at the way people use dynamite, in other words, to kill other people, that he established the Nobel Prize. And the first prize was the Peace Prize. But that would have been fine. But he established a committee he made a lot of money from this dynamite, millions. And he established a trust fund for the prize, which has grown over the years. And he established a committee to develop other areas for prizes. Now, up to this time, pretty late in the last century, science had been largely qualitative, and that science that was quantitative always first considered the qualitative aspects, the subjective part, the feeling, the emotional part of science. There is that part of science. If Nobel could know what has happened to his prize, I'm sure he would stop it instantly, because the Nobel Prize has almost ruined science, in my opinion. It has made it absolutely quantitative. There's no such thing as a Nobel Prize in ecology, for example. No such thing as a Nobel Prize for studying behavior. Strictly Nobel Prizes for quantitative science, things you can measure hard and fast and cold. And with all that money being offered and all that prestige being offered, science in the 1910s began to quantitative science began to mushroom, and it literally took over the universities, it took over industry. Somebody who won a Nobel Prize was somebody. And out of that grew the kind of science that developed the atomic bomb. And truly an unthinking science. Oppenheimer was a victim, not a progenitor of this thing. And I just, to my mind, my perceptions, it's an incredible irony that seems to me it came out of Nobel's efforts, and he passed it.
That doesn't speak to the question.
I know,
of whether,
I know. It's just something that bothers me. I keep
there any
science is changing a little, but it didn't start. It didn't start in the 30s or the 20s. It started in the last century. This thread running through. Incidentally, I believe firmly in satanic forces working in organized fashion. And I think I'd have to say that I see that there all the way through.
Aren't most scientific projects funded by the government?
Aren't most?
Yes, or all? Or where do they
get certainly.
Funded?
I don't know.
A vast majority of technological scientific projects are funded by industry in this country. Mm-hmm. The vast majority of basic research is funded by the government through universities and a little by industry. The Bell Telephone Company is probably one of the largest industrial supporters of just plain basic research. Industry has to have an immediate profit, a short-term profit, or else they don't think it's any good, except for Bell Telephone and a couple of others.
Was it extremely unusual in the early 40s for the government to be putting a lot of money into some research project? It wouldn't be now, but...
Well, no, it wasn't unusual, relatively speaking.
They said it was the largest expenditure of money for scientific research. They said that it became...
For a single project. For a single project, yes. But if you added up all their other projects, it wasn't that large. The other projects going on at the time were about 10 or 15 times the total amount of the Manhattan Project. But for a single project, this is way above whatever they've done before.
You know, sort of on that same idea, it was like, since we put so much money into this, we need to use what we've created, which the implications for that now are just terrifying with the defense money that's getting put in. It's like, is somebody going to finally come to the decision when all looks like the money?
I think there's a little question that the Nagasaki bomb was... superfluous to the stated objective of dropping the Hiroshima bomb. We had two different types of bombs. We wanted to test them both. Mm-hmm.
Except we'd already tested the plutonium bomb. That's the one they tested in New Mexico.
Well, we haven't tested it. We tested it on a flat desert. Mm-hmm.
We haven't observed its effects on the population. That was one of the ironic statements, horrifying statements of the film, I thought was the way they left those certain targeted cities untouched.
Yeah.
So that they could properly observe.
In the film, there was no consideration by the scientists after the first was dropped about what to insist on, if they were to insist on anything, vis-a-vis the second.
It was
bomb,
completely
right?
Out of their hands by that time. Mm-hmm. Once they had made the bomb.
Well, if it was a different
use.
I'm sure they had to come back to them for further assembly details and everything.
That's true. That's one issue that didn't really come up. They said after the victory in Europe Day, the VE Day, then there was very little discussion, or at least some discussion, on what would be the purpose of the bomb now, what would happen. But you would think after the horror of how it was first used, it's in some ways a little surprising that there wasn't more debate or consensus.
Was there any mention in the film of any consideration at that point, after the first and before the second?
I don't
That's a very short period of time.
It was under 1 or 2 days.
I think it was 10 days.
3 days.
3 days.
3 days.
It was strictly in the hands of the military, though, then.
Yeah, because it was last year, Mark Schultz said that they planned to drop the second on the 11th, but the weather conditions are so good on the 9th that they went ahead. And if we waited to the 11th, they would have seen it.
Well, Oppenheimer's statement that it was once they had made a bomb that was tested successfully, then it was the day after Trinity, it was too late. Then it was out of the hands of the scientists by then.
Marilyn?
I'd like to go back to the discussion about knowledge and the scientist's responsibility to make moral judgments at a certain point in a process. One thing that struck me in the film was the obvious brilliance of Oppenheimer, but his total ignorance of politics and world affairs up until, he was 23? Maybe he was older than that. But he was extremely naive in a huge sphere of life, and brilliant in one. And that seems kind of an extreme case, but maybe symbolic of what's true of most of us, is that we might know quite a lot about something, but that doesn't mean that we have all the knowledge that might be necessary to participate in other realms of life. And I think the compartmentalization of knowledge that Tom Witt mentioned in his session yesterday at 4 o'clock as being an operative in this whole process of the development of the weapon, as being obviously operative in Oppenheimer's life until his consciousness was raised by the fascist presence in Nazi Germany. I don't think that there is a certain point at which a scientist or any human being must now be moral or must now make moral judgments. When he said that it was too late the day after Trinity, it seemed to me that he was saying we should have been seeing connections all along, that they were operating in a kind of momentum and a kind of blindness. And I think he was in part confessing to that in his statement about the day after Trinity being too late. So to connect this to the current age and the current arms race, the question of whether we are seeing moral connections to our current arms race, whether we are blind in huge spheres of global reality, and therefore aren't really preparing to make sound moral judgments in the future. I think there's a whole question of human ability to control history and even to do something that you think is absolutely necessary in a given political situation, that this film helped to erode further my whole belief in the human ability to humanly control history with violence.
Did it erode your belief, or did it cement your suspicion that technology cannot be controlled? I mean, obviously, many technologies can be used for good or ill purposes.
No, I wouldn't say it that way. I would say that when people do not see that the morality of what they're developing is that they are also responsible for the uses and applications of something. That's not just true of the scientists, that's true of an American population right now that's going to fund the arms race, the continuing arms race, the escalation. The control of technology, I wonder if we can control it. Yes, because it seems to have a momentum, but by beginning to say, yes, reality is connected, and it isn't a politician's sphere to make a decision, or the military sphere to make a decision, or scientists about the uses of these weapons, but that we are connected to them, so are they, that it's everyone's issue and it's everyone's moral dilemma. I guess that's more of what I'm trying to say. The fact that we're not controlling technology is a fact. What to do from there?
Are you so suspicious? One might be so suspicious of the ability to see those connections that one just becomes a conservative on the development of technology. Mm-hmm. I'm not putting down that position at all.
I said specifically controlling destiny by means of violence. That's where my deepest suspicion lies.
Oppenheimer might have said, if he had had a very different outlook on things, the outlook of one outlook of retrospect. I have no idea whether this bomb is going to be used to win a war against Germany. No idea whether it's going to be used in a way that's necessary to win the war. We've learned that these kinds of decisions get out of not only our hands, but a lot of people's hands. And so we're just not going to develop it. Though it could, we could be passing up one of a very, very good purpose of such a weapon.
Could we not say that we are looking at this whole situation with historical hindsight because this is the one bomb that was created that we have seen the effects of? The other thousands and thousands that are being made every day, we have not yet seen the effects. But it seems the question she's asking is, you know, where in the whole continuum does one say no? Oppenheimer didn't say no, except afterwards when he saw it. And are we naive enough to imagine that we can argue for the fact that we would like not to use them? I mean, it seems, you know, we have the opportunity to move that line back, you know, and say, well, where do we say no? And That's the challenge, I
know. One place you might say no is right at the beginning.
Right.
Or you might have said no after VE Day, or after the first bomb.
Well, where do we say no? That's the question.
It seems to me we're talking about good or evil. When we talk about the atom bomb, it was developed for the single purpose of destruction, killing people, destroying property. At the same time that was being developed, many other weapons of war were being developed for the self-same objective. The only unique thing about the bomb was it was much more highly effective in its objective than were any of the other weapons that were being created. Nevertheless, it's a qualitative thing that I'm thinking of rather than a quantitative. And if it went, somebody who took the Springfield rifle, which was left over from World War I, which I did my basic training, and discarded it in favor of the M1, which could fire much more rapidly and had other advantages, qualitatively, this is the same type of thing. If we are creating weapons to kill people, what is the intrinsic difference between creating an atomic bomb to kill people and to destroy property, then just put their first 500-pound bomb in an airplane and drop it over some German city for the self-same purpose, except that one more effectively, more efficiently accomplishes its objective than the other. It seems to me we're talking about good and evil.
And therefore, we should not expect Oppenheimer to have, or the scientists to have raised any objection to developing the bomb
early. No more than Cole should have raised the objective when he developed the revolver.
Right.
It's a little Monday morning quarterbacking, if I may, and I'm wondering who among us in Oppenheimer's position would have stood up. Remember, he was competing with others who could have been granted that plum, probably the plum of the century as far as a physicist was concerned, that job running that project. And he was not under the control of political people. He was on the army payroll and had 6,000 people working with him.
And I wonder who among us would have stood up, say, halfway through or three-fourths of the way through that project and said, no, I stop.
Hey, I didn't get to see the movie. I'm sorry about that. I'll see it tomorrow morning, but you're dead right. Now, look, here's a kid, what, he's 22, 23? So, Bob, you're a chemical officer, and I'm moving 100,000 firebombs. Now, what difference is it whether it's 100,000 firebombs or whether it's Big Tom on Tinian? You see, there's no difference. And this 23-year-old kid, he can't say no. It's going on whether he wants to or not, and those planes are going to fly the next day, whether I want those 100,000 bombs to go or not. You know, we had a terrible job to do, and we didn't make day-to-day decisions on this thing. We were a cog in the wheel, and one guy carried a rifle, and somebody else moved the bombs or something else. No, it was not a moral judgment. We were trying our best to make bring it into a horrible moral mess.
But there were some who did say no earlier than that.
There were some, yes. Bless their heart. Yeah. But you know, we all had that judgment call to make. Do we try to take up arms against that sea of trouble and end it in Europe or in Japan? Some of us felt it was more decent at that point. Now, it's a different day. And I come down entirely different now. I can moralize much easier now, you know. But we made a different judgment call because we thought at that point, some of us, it was more decent to try to end that mess by doing something, going on the line. And that's about where Oppenheimer was. Anything, anything that we could do to end that one, we were going to do it. And that wasn't all that bad at points. We got it over with, and we've at least had a chance to hopefully develop some measure of a greater civilized world, perhaps, since. At least a chance.
I think it's true that at that age, you don't spend as much time in abstractly thinking these through things through. 3 years ago, my son, who was applying for conscientious objective status, asked me to write a letter to his draft board. And I remember one of the things I said was that I was firmly convinced that his decision not to be involved in this war was a conscientious moral decision arrived at out of his Christian heritage, and that although I had made a different decision, parenthetically, by serving in World War II, I fully respected his judgment. And the Bob Woodworth who respected his son's judgment was not the same Bob Woodworth who served during World War II. It wasn't the same war either, but something else.
Martin?
The same dispassionate kind of atmosphere which leaves us open to criticism now for money more quarterbacking also presents us with an opportunity, it seems to me. And that is that in the midst of this dispassionate atmosphere, we now have the opportunity to ask ourselves the question, under what circumstances will we personally approve of the use of nuclear weapons against an enemy? And I challenge us to make that decision now. While we can do it dispassionately, while we can look at while we can make a decision before we're confronted with the heat of the matter and let ourselves off the hook by the exigencies of the moment. I think the question is right now, do you or do you not, do I not countenance the use of nuclear weapons against other people for my own defense? And that question has to be answered now. It's not going to do any good to wait until later, until that decision is taken out of our hands, because the nuclear weapons are already in the hands of the battlefield commanders who are being overrun and who don't, in that very passionate moment, have a choice. but they use those. I want to make that decision now. I think it's important to make that decision now.
We certainly have had, despite the very traumatic event that the film was about, and we've had no sustained political discussion in this country on the matter you've raised. We haven't talked about whether a bomb should ever be used. If one hasn't landed, an atomic nuclear bomb has not already landed on our shores, etc. I mean, you can break the question down into many, many questions. And it doesn't seem to me that in the last 30 years we've had any of that discussion, significant discussion.
What percentage of people in this country do you think actually understand the consequences of that bomb, or what the destruction is that can wreak? I don't think it's very high.
Considering that millions are being spent to perfect that type of war equipment, I think, you know, that the decision is going to be made. It's going to have to be made, or we're going to be caught up in the same kind of thing as we were before, or those that were in charge, because we're living right in the midst of it. And whether it's a big bluff to scare off the enemy, quote, quote, or for what purpose it is, a battleship was pulled out of Bremerton the other day with the idea of equipping it. It's one that served in the Second World War. I saw it leave myself under tow, but it's going to be fixed. It's also thought that they will pull the Missouri out of it. In fact, it's destined to have four battleships. Well, if they're spending that kind of money, and we're paying for that in taxes, it's not coming anyplace else but from yours and my pocketbook. So who's making decisions there? And yet you see very little in any kind of decisions being made on this. We apparently made the decision when we voted in the people we vote in.
Well, we get
a lot. How we say no, or that how we say yes?
It can't be the. You have to look to some other decisions from parallels to see whether that's the only way we do it. We haven't done that with the MX missile. I mean, there's a considerable and heated congressional debate about
that. Well, I'm talking about the Trident.
Yeah. I mean, in terms of gravity of the issues, some kind of developed moral policy about the use of nuclear weapons is certainly much more important than the MX.
I'd still like to have somebody tell me, in what sense is moral to shoot a man with a bow and arrow, and immoral to kill him with a bomb? Numbers aside.
Yes.
As interpreter of the history, which is not my position, but is the position of blueprints, there are two criteria that are classic, that have been around for 1,000 years, that do make a difference. An M1, one man shoots one man because he's a combatant. You throw a bomb at a city, you hit people who are not combatant. That's a qualitative difference, not just a quantitative difference. Secondly, in the tradition, there is the call for proportionality, which is making a moral issue of quantity. If you only have to kill one man, it's a sin to kill three men, even if they're combatants. So those are classical criteria of the just war tradition, which do apply to the case you mentioned in 2X.
And I think with the atomic bomb, we might be able to add a third today, and that is that with the M1, one man kills one man who is then dead. But with the atomic bomb, we kill in many ways succeeding generations for probably on the average of 2,000 years. That's about the genetic effect that a bomb had on the population of those cities. And that's also about the length of time it takes for a human animal to develop an entirely separate race. So who knows, maybe what come out of it.
Just to point out the quantity for a minute, the calculus of overkill you can read is mind-boggling. If you take just the Soviet Union and the United States and destroy the 200 largest cities in each of those countries, it will require 400 warheads. At last count, we had in excess of 10,000.
Well, the reason for multiple warheads is simply to avoid them being wiped out before there's one enough left. So, under a certain policy, so is that what's a necessary thing?
Does it not seem ridiculous to some people? Is there anybody who that doesn't sound ridiculous?
No, 10,000 is not overkill if only 400 are necessary to wipe out the Soviet Union. If it's calculated that there are kinds of attacks that could wipe out 9,600 of those 10,000. And if you only had 5,000, all of them would get wiped out. Or you'd only have 200 left or whatever. There are many, many ways to calculate overkill.
Any kill is overkill.
We've been a change, though, in the United States' attitude toward the use of nuclear weapons. It seems like, in Oppenheimer's mind and other people, that this bomb might be used as a demonstration of what could be used. Lo and behold, it was actually used on human beings. Then they developed the mentality that we were going to balance the powers of the Soviet Union, who also had nuclear capacity, and the United States, where there would be a balance of terror, and that neither of us would start tossing bombs because we would be mutually assured of the destruction of one another, the MAD policy. Now we've heard talk about the viability and the rationale and even the justifiability of perhaps a first strike nuclear war and tactical nuclear war. I see a progressive deterioration in, it's a difference in the assumptions of what can be done with these weapons. It's not been an issue of public debate, but it's been an evolution in the assumption of what we would do with these weapons. At one time, it was a single course, and we decided to use these weapons. And now that's changed to the point where now we've developed first strike weapons. And people have not, in any majority sense, stopped and questioned the morality of those decisions all along that continuum. There have been a few. There have been the Daniel and Phil Berrigans and the other members of the Clarissa Eight. There have been people protesting since the publicity of the first atomic bomb, but there has not been a kind of people's rejection of this evolution of choice. And even to talk about overkill in this kind of mentality, to debate about what is kill and overkill, I don't want one of those bombs used on any city on God's earth. Seeing the effects on the people of Hiroshima and Nagasaki, the skin falling off their back. We didn't see anything in terms of what you can see in photographs, the effects on human beings. And I don't care for what political reason. I never want one of those used. I think it is totally unjustifiable in any sense, and based on Christian understanding of what it means to love an enemy, to shoot somebody with a bow and arrow or the rifle, I can't even handle that, let alone tossing a megaton bomb or a tactical nuke.
And you're talking about...
And I think that's the question we're facing now. Can we see, as Marty said, can we see any reason that we want those things thrown around the world?
And that judgment in your case holds against second strike as well as first strike?
Any strike.
On a bio.
Well, that's basically where I would come from, too. And the sooner, if we could ever make the moral commitment unilaterally, to completely disarm those things, the happier I'm going to be. But I don't see that in our country, especially in this environment.
Mm-hmm.
Is there a... You've made the previous, immediately previous, first strike and second strike distinction, perhaps unimportant, but to go back to that for a minute, can you say about a particular weapon system that it's first strike or second strike? Don't most of them fall into different, into both categories, first strike or second strike, depending on how they're wired up to control decisions, or, I mean, control centers?
What's that question about?
Well, it could be that a society would decide, should decide now. If you're right, Marilyn, about the fact that we're now considering first strike, first it was, no, we would never drop it, we would only develop it, and then have the discussion about how to control the whole international arms race, atomic arms race. Now, then we were at the balance of terror stage, and now we're at the point where we're even considering dropping, where we have developed first strike weapons. If you were to put that charge to somebody in the Pentagon, could they say plausibly, well, sure, you can take a lot of weapons we have and use them as first strike, but there's no weapon we have specifically developed for first strike.
My understanding is that it has to do with the accuracy of the weapon and being able to knock out the second strike capability of some adversary. That's what makes it a first strike weapon, is that it has the technical accuracy that you would wipe out the adversary's ability to throw anything back. And if the first strike language is used by Pentagon and military people, and that is a change in their own language, the way they talk about what they know. That's not a perceived, necessarily just a perceived change.
But then it makes it, but then it would have to, then they would describe it as preemptive first strike.
Mm-hmm.
Preemptive first strike. Not first strike, not dropping a bomb on some Middle Eastern country in order to make them give us oil, but instead dropping a bomb on a particular military, a particular nuclear weapon system in another country.
That's still a first strike, isn't it?
Sure. There may or may not be a moral difference.
All strikes aside, I'd like to throw in a very simple thought here. When we use the phrase society making a decision, I think at this point that's inconceivable, because there needs to be knowledge, first of all, on what percentage of our population can even scratch the surface on any everyday conversation of, I mean, I've learned a lot since I've been here of what exists. And what scares me, just like what the film showed, was this big undercover secret deal that people didn't know about. And what do we really know that's being, you know, made, that's going on, you know? What do people know in different states that's tunneling underneath them, you know?
What kinds of weapons really are being developed?
Yeah, you know, what are we walking around over or walking around under? And I don't know how we can talk about decisions, you know. I think that's great, very ideal, but there needs to be knowledge first. And, you know, when we talk about taxpayers, people just, I don't think, much. So initially, there's that responsibility to individuals to find out, and how can you move? How do we really know?
If you read everything that was published on that, you would be finding liars among the military, liars among the pacifists, people partly informed in both groups. Everybody's trying to sell a point of view, and you read it. It's extremely difficult, if not impossible, to read protagonists and the various people involved in different areas of knowledge, different points of view, and decide who is right so that you can be the judge. It isn't a matter just of us blindly not studying these things. You don't know what to believe. I don't know.
could be, if you had a lot of education about the subject, that the populace would vote definitively for
the
Boer very large second strike capabilities.
It seems to me that what we know now is sufficient to move us to some sort, or should be sufficient to move us to some sort of protest and action. Just knowing the billions of dollars that are being poured into nuclear weapons production, and at least we have some idea of the kinds of the power of the weapons that are being produced and those kinds of things. We could delay a long time trying to learn much more in detail about those bombs, or to ask about the second strike and the first strike and all these kinds of things. But I don't think we have the time, or almost the, what am I trying to say? I guess I feel we know enough.
It seems to me there's one more thing that needs to be thrown into the whole discussion, though, at least as Christian's talking about the whole threat of nuclear weapons, and that's the whole matter of Christian hope. It seems to me that's very important, because you're not just like, yes, the film can shatter illusions, and yes, it can say to people, you need to do something, but it seems to me that you also have to have the hope and trust that somehow the story of Jesus and the message of the gospel has something to say about what kind of a response we can make, even when things seem hopeless, even when by the world standards nothing is going to happen, even when it seems like the vast majority of people in the country are not going to do anything, even when it seems like the practical sorts of things that we might try aren't working, that we still have this hope to sustain us. And it seems to me that's very important, and we shouldn't forget.